Okay, so
oh, here, just, here, roll this over.
And then you'll see.
There we are.
Just click on the button. Here,
you're there. Okay,
them.
Good.
And when you want to unmute them, just unmute them.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Saba. Save the day. Save the day. All right, here we go. I'm sorry for the lost time. In the downloads, John Bordney, enlarge.
It was hard to believe that if we had to launch these missiles, that we were in the last minutes of our life, and that within days there would be virtually no life left on the planet. I can't explain the feeling that I had. It's something that I only had once and I've never had since then. A bone-chilling, numbing feeling. I think time was kind of irrelevant at that time, and it had no meaning. Things just kind of was removed from time. Nobody wants to begin the end of the world, because that's what it would be, because you'd have nuclear winter, and who knows how much would survive and what kind of genetic mutations would happen. I thought since I was got permission to publish it, and I might as well talk about it. When I put the memoir together, and everything came back, and nothing was redacted. I couldn't get over it. I said, "Are you sure you read it?" Because I thought, sure, they'd take the part out of me being locked in a launch bay for 14 hours, although we're in unsafe condition with two other guys. But nope, there wasn't one black line in the whole memoir. I was 19 when I joined the Air Force, and turned 21 on Okinawa. I did not want to be a missileer. In fact, I wanted to fly. When we were in Lackland, the captain that gave us our assignments said that we've got you slated for missiles, because I had taken some college in electrical engineering. The problem with the Mace A is it couldn't go over a large body of water. It would tend to get lost. Mace B was designed to go over large bodies of water, such as huge lakes and oceans. There was a few of us in the Missile A training course, and they took the best of the best to migrate into the Mace B, because they had heard that the B sites in Germany were coming online faster than they thought. And when I first met Captain Bassett, I was introduced to him and the crew, and we had a nice little get-together and talking about who was doing what on the crew and whose responsibility was. He was shocked, and so was the rest of the crew, to find out I had no experience on the B-Bird at all. In the mornings, I would go to hands-on training. Then in the afternoons, I would go to class, and that would last till whoever knew, 5, 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, depending on the subject. We had an excellent relationship. He was the best officer we had ever met in the Air Force. And I maintained that until the time I got out. He was the best officer I had ever served with and knew. Now, when we got to Okinawa, we were told that the missiles had some work to do. And when we got out there the first day, it looked like a lot to us. And we had to pull the cables, test all the cables. We dropped the first missile in January 1st of 1962 in Bay 1 of Bolo Point. And that's when our missile site officially became operational. As the sites came up, the crews that were assigned to those sites became operational. So we would rotate through the various shifts, and then at the end of the third shift, we would have about 3 or 4 days off. Basically, it came down to card playing or reading books. And if we didn't have anything to do, that's exactly what we did. We would be notified if there was a recycle scheduled and what site and which of the 8 missiles at the bay would be recycled. And if we had to do a recycle, then we were told what time we would drop the power to the missile. There was a periodic weather report that came in roughly mid-shift, and then it had a code associated to it. The sequence of events there was that the MEC-1 would go in, write down everything, and then he would check the one part of the code with what he had in his pouch, and normally nothing matched. Periodically, they would do a test, and his would match, which called the NCO in, and he had to verify the second part of it. That would never match. We had learned in the, I guess it was the beginning of September, that some Cuban refugees were coming out of Cuba, and that there was some missile sites starting to be built. And we found out that they were SAM sites. Then in the middle of October, some more refugees told us that there was about 50 SAM sites already operational. There was also increased chatter between Cuba and Russia, but it was scrambles type chatter. But it was just seemed strange that there was more chatter going on. There was a report from somebody that there was possibly SS-3 or SS-4 missiles in Cuba, and there was sites being prepared for them. So this kind of prompted a lot of oversight, overflights, I should say, by our recons to find out exactly what was going on there. When we learned that President Kennedy was going to give a speech, we gathered in the barracks, and there was standing room only around the television set. There was dead silence while he was talking. And then after he got finished, there was dead silence, and everybody just kind of was in shock to hear what he had to say. And then that was really when we got the impression that we were really going to have to do what we were paid to do. I was very concerned about my parents because they lived about 20 miles from New York City. During the lead up to the 28th, I had called my parents several times on the phone trying to talk them into going down to North Carolina to visit my grandmother. I was very concerned, and we were told not to discuss it with her, with anybody. And so I couldn't say what I wanted to say to them to get them down to North Carolina. So everybody wanted to be on a crew that would, if we had to launch a missile, would be there to retaliate for our side. It got to the point where people were offering a lot of money. And the most I was offered was about $1,000. There was no way I was going to take $1,000 for one shift, because I wanted to be out there too. So we were told before this, when President Kennedy gave his speech, that we were not going to recycle any missiles. There'd be no test communications of any kind. So we're playing cards, and they were told to stand by for incoming message. So Gino went in there. When he got the first part of the launch order confirmed by what he had in his pouch, he got very upset, and he called the captain in to take a look and verify that he had done everything correctly. So we all went into the launch control center at that time because we had a bad feeling about this. And sure enough, the codes matched. The NCO opened up his pouch, codes matched. Well, Captain Bassett verified that he did it correctly, everything matched, which meant now that the launch officer had to open his pouch. And in his pouch contained the keys and the actual destination for each missile. Before he opened his pouch, he said that he may have to launch missiles. If anybody did not accept the fact that we had to launch a missile and tried to interfere, he would have to shoot us. And which I felt embarrassed, and I was kind of hurt that he would say that, because we would not go against whatever he decided. Because if we launched them and we should not have, then we'd be shot for treason. And if we were supposed to launch them and we did not launch them, we'd be shot for treason. So we all decided that we'd all get shot, or nobody would get shot, because that's the way crews operate. Did Russia launch a preemptive strike? That got us very nervous, because there were only 10 to 15 minutes flight time from Russia, from the east coast of Russia. At that point, the phone rang. It was one of the other launch sites wanting to know if we had got the same message that Captain Bassett had gotten. The captain started checking all the other launch sites and seeing if everybody had gotten the same message. Then we started to talk about why we got this launch message, because we were still at DEFCON 2. Now, when we were discussing that option over the phone, the captain pointed to Gino and went 1-2, and that meant for Gino to spool up those two missiles and pointed at me and said, 3-4. So I knew what that meant. So I proceeded. You have to spool it up to pre-launch status. And what that does is it rapidly checks everything in the missile, make sure everything was cleared to launch. And then somebody else suggested that in one of the pre-shift briefings that a U-2 had been shot down. President Kennedy said that another U-2 got shot down, that they were going to invade Cuba with conventional means. So did that happen? Did we start the invasion through conventional means and it turned nuclear over there in Cuba and the rest of the United States? We thought that if that happened, we would have been raised to DEFCON 1, where we would have permission to launch the missiles. If we didn't have permissions, we would not launch them. We were told that we had to launch all the missiles. But we only had one missile headed towards Russia, and we did not see why we should have to involve the other countries in a nuclear exchange between Russia and the United States. So this caused problems. The captain suggested that everybody crack the doors open so it would take less time to launch a missile if the doors were cracked open. The only thing that had to happen at that time was the rod would come out at the top, push the door open, and it would fall open. So it would open up in a matter of seconds. Otherwise, if there had been a nuclear explosion, the overpressure would push the door shut again. And then we could go through the opening of the process. The captain wanted a retransmission, you know, to try to prompt the major to see whether this was correct or not. And he retransmitted, and it came back the same. B, called Captain Bassett, said that your lieutenant on the A side was preparing to launch all four missiles because he was the only one of the four sites that had all four missiles going to Russia. He said that the major's command to launch, so preceded and took precedence over Captain Bassett, and he was going ahead to launch those missiles. He was getting close to, if not having all the missiles at pre-launch status, I would say. The launch officer on the B side was told to send two men over there with 45s and to shoot anybody that tried to launch until the situation was resolved. I would say it would only take them about a minute or so to get over there because they would have to take the weapons out of the gun closet, and I would imagine they'd be loading the clips as they were running over. And it would only take like 15, 20 seconds to run the distance between the two command centers. So those two men kept that whole crew at bay while we made a decision as to what to do. Something bothered me about the retransmission. I thought that it was strange that it was that a launch order was transmitted at the same time the weather check was transmitted. That he seemed like he was upset. He should have been nervous, or should not have been upset. He should have been nervous. So I voiced that opinion. And the captain said that was good thinking. And he called the major back at MOC and said, kindly issue one of two things, either the upgrade to DEFCON 1 so we can act on your transmission, or issue the stand down command. And it wasn't very long, maybe 2 or 3 seconds later, where a very nervous major came over the intercom issuing the stand down order. And then we just kind of looked at each other like we could have exterminated the whole planet. We backed the missile back down to the hold status. And we went out and we were sitting around the table discussing the situation. And we were really critiquing everything that we did. then I had a thought that scared the living daylights out of me. And I had to pose a question to the captain. The captain was, what would happen if we had experienced earth tremors during that time? And everybody just kind of sat there in silence. When we first experienced our earth tremors, we were wondering if that's what a nuclear missile would feel like going off and sound like, because we were on shock-mounted floors and everything kind of swayed and vibrated, and there was a deep rumbling sound if it was a bad earth tremor. And that, the first experience of that really scared us. Then when we were sitting around discussing everything, everything started to come back down and we started to unwind. And that's when I realized how nervous I was. Now, I was the only person on the crew that smoked. So I asked the captain if I could light up a cigarette. He said, go ahead, be my guest. He says, if I smoked, I would be smoking one too. And the NCO had quit smoking. And he says, well, let me have one. I think I'm going to restart. We realized that our basic training had kicked in, because we were told that if you're in a crisis situation, don't panic, because if you panic, you're going to die. So the next crew came in, and they realized something had happened, because the major had taken himself off of the line and let his number two take over his slot. They were wondering why, but they weren't told why. And they came in, and oh, they were inquisitive. They really wanted to know what went on, and we just kind of kept our mouths shut, and we all looked at the captain, and the captain eventually said, shit happened. Excuse the expression. And just by the fact we couldn't confirm or deny their speculation, everybody said, well, yeah, they did get the launch order. But, you know, they didn't really know for sure. And we couldn't tell our folks. We couldn't tell relatives. We couldn't tell anybody about it. Yes, I was the last man in line going up. And we had yellow hats on, and when the door opened, it looked like a big yellow line coming back down to me. And I said, well, one of these days I'm going to have to write a book about this, and I'll call it The Long Yellow Line. But when we got topside, this was the only time we were not in a hurry to get back to the barracks. We just kind of, both crews just kind of stood there looking. That morning is just as familiar to me and as clear as yesterday morning is. And this is 53 years later, and how clear blue the sky was. And it was just some very light clouds, and there was a perfect breeze blowing, and the perfect temperature. I did not know what the temperature was, but it just felt perfect. And we were all just kind of taking it in, and taking in the smell of the air, and the sea and the land mixture together, and everything smelled so beautiful. I had often wondered whether that was God's way of saying, thank you for preserving my creation. You know, over the years, I've often thought about, I wouldn't have had the pleasure of meeting my wife and knowing my sons.
And your granddaughter.
I thought my grandchildren. You know, we had such a tight-knit crew that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, especially the situation we're talking about, that I think that was the only time I experienced that it was a, I wouldn't say community, but it was a band of brothers, right? And everybody was equal. There was no rank difference, because everybody was discussing the same problem, because it may be everybody's last few minutes of being on the earth. So rank kind of went out the window. Yes, there was a court-martial. I think it was around December or January, where the captain told us that he had been demoted to second lieutenant and put like third or fourth in charge of the base laundry. And since he had about 19 years and 11 months in, they told him that 20 years to put in his retirement papers, and he retired as a second lieutenant.
I want to apologize. It was me who was causing the problem with the echoes because I had the UN web thing on and it was there on a 10-second delay. That's why it was cycling over and over again. So apologies for that from my end. We'll go back to Skype, and I would like to ask Professor Robach to turn on his microphone and turn off the webcast so that he can tell us about the second part of the risk equation. Risk is a product of the probability of something happening times the consequences of it occurring. We have been hearing from Airman Bordney about the probability, which we hope is extremely small and yet obviously not zero, that something could go terribly wrong. And we'll hear from Professor Robach of Rutgers University, who is a volcanologist and climatologist, about the consequences that would have resulted had all of the missiles on Okinawa been fired at their destinations in East Asia. I hope Dr. Robach is now ready to take over. I pass it to you. Go ahead, Alan. It's going to take him 10 seconds to hear me say that. Go ahead, Alan. Is he speaking? Oh. Yeah, you're right. I need to turn the microphone on. Hold on. It's over here. And take the mute off. Okay, now, Alan, if you talk, we can hear you. Not hearing me. Why would that be?
There he is. Now we're not hearing him.
Go ahead. Alan.
He's muted.
No, he's not. He's not muted.
He's muted.
Or maybe he's muting himself.
He's muted himself.
Yeah. Oh, Alan, turn off the mute button if you can hear me. Turn off the mute button on your side. Okay, Alan, we can see that you're talking, but we can't hear what you're saying. Hold on, let me try something here. Alan, we can hear that you're talking, but we can't hear what you're saying. Can you hear me, Alan?
No.
Damn it. There's no reason why, at our end, why we shouldn't be hearing him.
Why don't we go to something else then?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna restart just Alan. Okay. Bear with us.
Why don't we go to some of the people in the room?
Okay.
So we know we'll have something.
Okay. Just a sec. Call.
While you're doing that, we could.
Okay, I've got the volume now. Alan, is your mute? Can you hear me, Alan? Oh, my God. He's telling us some fantastic stuff and we can't hear him. He's not muted at this end.
Do you have his telephone number? Okay.
No.
Well,
oh, no.
Why don't we go live here and then fix that while we're going live?
Alan, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We had problems with the audio at this end. If you could start from the beginning, I hope we can hear you this time. No, we can't. What the heck is going on? We had no problems when we were testing this earlier. Where's Saba when we need her? Yeah, okay. Here, we're going to try something else, Alan.
Try Ellsberg.
No, there's no point in that. Alan, can you call us so we have just you on the screen? Okay? All right. There's some wrinkles here, obviously. I apologize.
Aaron, you want to go live?
Here we go. Hi, Alan. You're on. Go for it.
Okay, I'll start over.
Thank you.
John mentioned that it would be like the end of the world, that there would be a nuclear winter from the climate effects of such...
the effects of a Hiroshima bomb, it would burn an area about 15 miles, 25 kilometers in radius. And we've calculated how much smoke this would put into the atmosphere from these 32 targets, about 15 million tons of smoke. We all know how horrible the direct effects of nuclear weapons would be because of what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And directly, that would be a horrible catastrophe for the people that targeted. But this smoke would last for more than a decade in the upper atmosphere, being blown around the world by the winds and absorbing sunlight, making it cold and dark at the Earth's surface. A full-scale war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union would produce so much smoke that the temperatures would be below freezing. It would be nuclear winter. And unfortunately, the current arsenals can still produce that. If this had happened 50 years ago, we calculated that these cities would be smaller, and so there would be less material to burn. And also, we calculated, based on the size of the weapons, about 15 million tons of smoke. That's about three times the amount of smoke that would be produced by a small war between India and Pakistan that we've studied in detail. This means global temperatures would fall by 4 degrees Celsius on the average and more over land. That's about 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit. If you could imagine trying to do agriculture with temperatures that much colder, with less sunlight, with less rain, with excess ultraviolet radiation, you can imagine that most agriculture in the world would come to a halt. And so this would have sentenced the planet to a global famine. Billions of people might have died. And we didn't even know that we had this capability back then. But just these 32 weapons would have done that. And of course, if there had been a retaliation, more strikes, more targets in Russia, Soviet Union, and in the United States, there would have been even more smoke. So we were very lucky in this case and in other cases to have avoided this. And we've been lucky for 70 years. Unfortunately, there are many more weapons in the world now than 32. There are 9 countries with nuclear weapons, and 8 of them, excluding North Korea, having a very small interchange could produce more that much smoke. India, Pakistan, Israel, China, as well as UK, France, Britain, and the United States and Russia. So it would have been a terrible catastrophe. You would have been sitting in the United States and seen this sky getting darker, black smoke coming over. Farmers would have, this was in October, and so most agriculture in the Northern Hemisphere was already over, but the next summer it would have been virtually impossible to grow any food. People could have adapted. They could have eaten what they had stored. They could have thought about planting other crops, but it would have been a terrible catastrophe, and that's what would have happened in this scenario. Yes.
Great. Thank you so much for that into that short briefing on what the consequences could have been if just those 32 nuclear weapons had hit their targets. We're now going to give the audience a chance, and Alan, I'm going to drop you here so that we can bring John Bordney up. We're going to give the audience a chance to ask questions of John Bordney directly about about the incident itself. Any clarification you want, any further insight into what he and his crew members were experiencing, any further details that he can provide about the conversations that his captain, William Bassett, was having with the other launch officers on the other sites. You're welcome to come and sit here so that you'll be like having a Skype conversation directly with him, and people will see what he's saying in response up on the screen. But rather than me taking my computer around and risking even further technical problems, I would ask you to come, don't be shy, to come here and sit next to me, and I will point the camera at you, and you can ask your question of John Bordney about any aspect of the description of the incident that you found particularly interesting or confusing or too technical or whatever, and he'll help with that. So I'm going to bring John Bordney online by himself. Sorry, Dan, we're going to hold off on you for a few more minutes. And I welcome anybody to step forward. This is the first you've heard of this, maybe. Maybe some of you read the article that was of mine that came out in a Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists on Monday. Gives more detail. But this is a chance to talk to someone who is involved in helping to preserve us long enough to maybe get rid of nuclear weapons someday. John's, you're ready to take questions?
Bam.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
When you are looking at the screen right now, you see me, I hope.
Yep.
Yes, do.
You do. Good. No. Okay.
Well, I just have your picture up.
Yeah. Oh, just my picture. Okay. I can correct that easily. Hello?
Hello. Gotcha.
Okay.
Why don't I break the ice?
Yeah, here we go. Bruce Blair is going to break the ice.
Hey, John.
Okay. Hello, Bruce.
Hit the mic.
Hi.
So we get
put that mic
on
now.
Hi, John. I'll break the ice.
Put the camera here.
Right. John, I had, first of all, a technical question that I think is very significant, and that's the channel, radio channel, over which you received the launch codes that authenticated. Was that the primary channel for the transmission of launch orders, or was that a secondary channel?
Well, it was over the primary channel. I can't get very much into detail about the channel, because that wasn't my responsibility. That was the captain. We just heard everything come across at one time.
Okay. My guess is that it was a secondary channel, and that the problem that occurred was the snafu that happened was that a launch order was inadvertently transmitted through a secondary channel. But I'll return to that point in my comments later on. The other thing on my mind is more of an observation, which is that the U.S. Strategic Nuclear War Plan was not revised to allow for withholding attacks against China in the event of war with the Soviet Union until 2 months before the incident. And
you're
so,
uh-oh.
Yeah, you're starting to cut out.
Okay, let me try to repeat myself a little more slowly. The U.S. strategic nuclear war plan was not revised to allow for withholding of strikes against China in the event of a nuclear war with the Soviet Union until 2 months before the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so I was sort of struck that your common sense view was that it wouldn't make sense not to be able to withhold strikes against China in the event of a war with the Soviet Union. Just an observation that I think to raise here. That's all I have.
Okay, this was to talk on that a little bit. We had gotten instructions that you had to launch all the missiles at the, you know, when we were in training, and we heard nothing to the contrary up till that point. So, as far as we were concerned, we had to launch all of them. That's the thing that we were objecting to.
Yeah, I guess the word did not get down to you during that 2 month lapse.
Thanks, John. Jonathan Granoff has a question.
Well, first, John, I want to thank you on behalf of probably millions, if not billions, of people that you've brought this incident to light, because it highlights the precarious situation the world was in then and remains in now. I wondered, did you have the opportunity to give your testimony to the U.S. military prior to today?
I didn't give testimony, no, but I did produce this memoir, which is rather thick, and they did authorize it, and that was what we had to have done before I talked to Dr. Oda about it, and because I didn't want to know, because I wanted to know whether I could actually speak on the subject, but they had notarized everything and stamped everything approved, and nothing was redacted. So if I could print it, I guess I can talk about it.
So I want to make sure everybody's clear. So you have submitted the content that you shared with us to the U.S. military. They've reviewed it and redacted, took nothing out of it.
That's correct. Let me just get that top sheet over here so you can see it. I don't know if you can see it or not. Is it too bright?
It's the blue stamp on the lower right, and there's at the top there's the date, the case number and the case number.
Right.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. So one of the outcomes of this, was there an official investigation of some kind that took place that has not been made public?
Well, it was court-martial. We got the results maybe a month or two after the event. So I can't get any more specific about that because only the officers were involved.
Can you tell us who was court-martialed?
He did in the tape.
Yeah, I know.
I don't remember his name, no. That's the problem here. Nobody knows or can remember that major's name. I talked to several of my friends that were at the launch site and also at 873rd members. They don't remember what his name was either.
So therefore, there are questions. There are issues that we're certain of, that they've approved your account, and there are issues that remain very open that really need to be investigated. Would that be correct?
That's correct. And I got an email from Richard Wilt, who's the director of Air Force Historical Support Division, and I will be answering any of his questions so he can get this investigation verification in motion, so it'll probably come up sooner rather than later.
Well, I want to thank you, and I hope that your coming forward today will stimulate a great deal of investigation and make this entire incident transparent to the public so we can be an informed democracy.
Well, I think it's very important to get our side in because it, have you read the 1 Minute to Midnight book by Mr. Dunn? Because that gives the Russians' viewpoint on what happened and their use of restraint. And I think it's important that we get our side out to the public, put in the historical books that we were also able to use restraint.
Thank you.
John, you were just being grilled by a lawyer there. You dispatched yourself very well, I must say. I want to throw up.
Represented by a lawyer too. Then.
I want to throw up on the screen another legal thing that's underway that wasn't mentioned in the video, but is mentioned in the article in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and there's a operation called the National Security Archives. It's based at George Washington University in Washington. And they have put in requests in July, and I think the other one was earlier in June. Yeah, in June, specifically asking for whatever information there may be on the court-martial and the inquest related to it, and also more generally the full history of the unit from the time it arrived in Okinawa in 1961, John being among the first people arriving for that assignment, and when it was shut down in 1969 and the island was turned back to Japan. So this is a slow process. It's the Freedom of Information Act in the United States. It's a slow process, but it could well produce some very relevant and important documents that'll give us an even fuller insight into what happened that night when John was on duty. Do we have any other questions at this point? Come on over here, Janice. And then we're going to move on to the panel because we've got, you've already heard from two people here, but Dan Ellsberg is waiting in the wings somewhere out there in cyberspace, and we want to bring him in. Directly to John.
Hello, my name is Janice Hall, and I first want to thank you very much for your dedicated service and your courage, not only to serve, but your courage in standing up for this story. It's just a simple question. I'm rather curious as to whether you've kept in touch with the members of your group, and if there's sort of been any sort of unified effort with your colleagues who experienced this 14-hour period. Was it 14 hours, this trying period? I had that number written down. Where you've collaborated with them. Are you in touch with them? Are you collaborating with them at this point? I'm kind of curious as to where they stand.
John, before you answer that.
I'd like
that
to make a correction there. Yeah. This event did not take 14 hours. That 14 hours was in reference to war in unsafe condition.
Okay.
And yes, I am in touch with some missileers. In fact, today is the beginning of their reunion down in Florida. They're going to be going to Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral and Washington Missile Launch. So I sent the article to the president. I don't know whether he'll be presenting it in front of the crew during their get-together or not, but it's up to him. But there was a fellow there that I'm in contact with that is going to the reunion, and he's going to be asking around to see if anybody there can remember anything, and especially the two other events in Germany, which we're not getting into yet, because I know they happened, but they haven't been verified by anybody. So he's going to be asking around about those two events, see if anybody would want to contribute to this historical.
Thank you.
I could add there, just to give a broad picture, you have to understand there were eight sites. There were eight launch centers, each manned by seven people, and each had to have three shifts. So you're talking about something like 200 people who were on Okinawa. But less than a third of them were actually on duty the night that the event, the incident occurred. And the others might have sensed that something was happening, but they it was not revealed in any detail to the rest of the people on the missiles. So it is a bit of a task to track down people. I want to mention that the person who supported the original breaking story on this back in March, which came out in a Japanese news service, I had John arranged for me to have a chance to talk with him late last week. And it was really fascinating to get another perspective on this. Unfortunately, he was not in the launch control center, so he could not overhear what Captain Bassett was saying to the other launch officers. So he knew what happened at the beginning of the incident, and he knew what happened at the end of the incident when they all came back together to sort of decompress. And he was in greatest admiration of Captain Bassett, but he did not have anything like the kind of detailed insight into the incident that John had, because he was literally just a few steps away from Captain Bassett. We will now move on to the panel session. If someone could turn up the lights, that would be good, I think.
Daniel Ellsberg.
And we're going to bring Daniel Ellsberg into the picture. Sorry, Dan, we've had you in the background now. We bring Dan into the picture and turn up the lights. Yeah, thank you. And wow.